So this is an afternoon lecture, so I want to take it easy on myself. So I'm going to talk about some of my own research or stuff, my current interests. So I'm going to talk about this program of trying to derive quantum theory from some more basic postulates. So to do that, I'll also have to set up some of the basics for a sort of framework that's come to be called generalized probability theory. But first, let me talk about the motivation for this kind of program. So we have kind of, if you look back at the history of physics, we have this kind of ad hoc sort of statements of laws, and then we have more explanatory versions of the laws of physics. So, for example, Kepler's laws of planetary motion were very good for predicting certain quantitative features of planetary motion. But they also seem very unnatural. There's not really a sense in which they explain why the planets move the way they do. You have to wait till Newton to before you see something like an explanation. His dynamics plus his law of universal gravitation certainly seems a lot more natural than this. Not the final word, obviously, but certainly more natural than just accepting Kepler's laws. Likewise, the Lorentz transformations were known as the transformations under which Maxwell's equations were invariant. But they're very strange mathematically. They're not the sort of things you would write down as being natural. It's only when you have Einstein's postulates for special relativity that these look natural. So what about the standard axioms of quantum theory in Hilbert space? I think it's one can claim that they are in a certain sense quite ad hoc. They're not the sort of things you would write down if you were just trying to think of a physical theory. They have much more in common with Kepler's laws and the Lorentz transformations than they do with the work of Newton or Einstein. So the attempt is to find something more natural. And if you manage to really do that, I certainly don't claim to have anything on the par with this. But if you really manage to do this, you'd find yourself in good company. I mean these two postulates for special relativity. So that the speed of light is independent of the source and that the physics is the same in all inertial reference frames.
So these are axioms that you use to derive some prediction from the same as for the axioms of quantum theory.
The argument I'm making is that one can these postulates have they're more natural in a physical sense. That laws of physics should be the same in any inertial frame seems like a natural thing to require. Whereas these axioms that here that you have a Hilbert space, you have a complex Hilbert space. It doesn't seem like a very natural requirement. I think there's a difference in character between these sorts of requirements.
This is something physical, and this is more like mathematical.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. And I mean, I think this kind of argument, you're never really going to, never going to be able to complain anything is completely explanatory, or I don't get. It's more of a matter of judgment. And my feeling is that. Is that these are more physical in nature, they're sort of like physical principles, whereas these, and they appeal to some kind of intuitive notions we have about the physical world. Whereas this, I don't think anyone would have written them down for physical reasons. You had a...
I was going to say, I mean, it's almost the same question, but rather about the Newton case, but I mean, there's a pretty strong analogy between it. If you just took like the L2 of R3 case instead of the abstract Hilbert space formulation, and you wrote down the usual like Schrodinger equation and stuff.
But when you said I take L2 of...
Like you took your Hilbert space to be the L2 complex value functions on R3.
Okay, yep.
Then you could, I mean, there's like, this whole correspondence principle thing. You could like essentially probably for everything in the Newton list, you have some corresponding thing on the quantum theory side. And
right.
It seemed like postulating comparable things, which is like, kind of...
But you still don't, I mean, just the question as to why you have complex numbers is not really sort of very mathematical. There's no real clear physical reason for that.
I guess you can ask, why do we have Kepler's laws? And the answer is the explanation is not the same for gravity. You can ask, why do we have Lorentz transformations? The answer is not the questions, but
right.
Asking why we have the axioms of...
Well, so my hope is that one can find something over here. And it's a bit more than that, because if you really manage to find the right thing here, then you can see that in each of these cases, you manage to very quickly go beyond this. So Newton's laws are much more general than Kepler's laws. Even if you restrict yourself to the motions of heavenly bodies, then these don't account for hyperbolic motion. They only account for elliptical motion. Over here, special relativity led to general relativity. And furthermore, even special relativity applied much more broadly than to just Maxwell's equations. So there's a sense in which you're going to new physics. So hopefully, if you really understand, if you have some physical understanding of where these more abstract mathematical axioms come from, you might be in a good position to move beyond quantum theory to some deeper theory. That's the hope. This is all very subjective, and it's a matter of judgment. But that's the kind of motivation for this kind of program. And it's an old problem. People have been asking this kind of question going way back. I think von Neumann was one of the first people to attempt to answer this kind of question. And there's a tradition of quantum logic, which starts with von Neumann and others, Mackey, and there's a lot of work back in the 60s, especially, thinking about this. But the subject kind of lay dormant for a long time. And then with the advent of quantum information, people got a new set of tools to try and think about this approach. Chris Fuchs was very instrumental in getting this question going again. So this would be a nice thing to do. Certainly be nice if you could do it in such a way that it would help make progress to go beyond just the standard structure of quantum theory. So how would we even go about answering a question like that? So one way to do it is to try to find principles that apply in some broader framework that then narrow you down to quantum theory. And so the framework I'm going to talk about is the so general probabilistic framework, so general probabilities framework. And the idea is that this is a way of talking about probabilistic theories, and it encompasses quantum theory and classical probabilistic theory and maybe other probabilistic theories also. Well, first of all, let me get some motivation from quantum theory. which we're all very familiar with by now. In quantum theory, you calculate the probability for some preparation followed by some measurement by looking at the trace of a row where A is a positive operator associated with the outcome that you're trying to calculate the probability for. And rho is the density operator. You're looking for the probability of getting some particular outcome associated with this positive operator. This object I've mentioned a few times is linear in probabilities. I'll explain what I mean by that. And this formula here, the trace of something times this is a linear formula on rho. So you can write this down like so. Where you calculate this vector of probabilities, P, from the density matrix, and this dual vector you calculate from the positive operator. So here, P is a list of probabilities. So I gave you an example like this for a qubit or spin half particles in previous lectures. That's an example when you have a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Just the same thing as taking the dot product. Is that clear what I'm saying? Yeah. Yeah. So you can see from this that you have to have an equation like this, and in the quantum case, these states will belong to some set. And that corresponds to the fact that in quantum theory, the density operators belong to a set of positive operators that have normalization less than or equal to one.
So usually rho and A are represented as matrices, and what you're saying is that they can also be represented as vectors.
That's right. Yeah. So I showed you how to do that in the case of a qubit. Remember I talked about how you can just take this. Basically, the real all you need is a certain number of real numbers to specify these objects, and you can arrange those real numbers in a matrix or in a vector. It's a matter of convenience. So what's nice about the standard quantum way of writing down these objects is that you then have very natural ways of constraining them so that you get the quantum allowed set of states, just the positive operators that have normalization less than or equal to one. Whereas this set S is defined in a less natural way for quantum theory. The advantage, though, of this way of thinking is that suddenly you can consider a whole class of probability theories that have the same kind of form, that have different sets, S perhaps. So you can situate quantum theory in the context of a general set of probability type theories. In quantum theory, you can consider taking a mixture of operators, of density operators, so if you have a coin, a lambda biased coin, and you toss it, if you get heads, then you prepare the state rho A. And if you get tails, you prepare the state rho B. And the state that you end up preparing in this way is this state. This is a convex mixture of those things. And in this P vector language, you just get this. It's the same thing. Really, the reason this works in quantum theory is because these density operators are linear in probability. Does anyone know how to convert between, or how to turn a density matrix into a P vector in a general way? Any guesses how you do that?
Take a list of entries.
Take a list of
of the matrix entries.
The problem with that is that those aren't all probabilities, because the off diagonal matrix entries are complex numbers. So even if you take the real and imaginary parts of those, though they're not probabilities, they're something else. They can be less than zero, for example.
So you want these all to be real probabilities in some sense?
They should all be probabilities. Okay.
Take a set of take PVM.
That's definitely one way to do it. Just to take more generally, what you need to do is take a set of projection operators which span the space of projection operators, or more generally, span the space of emission operators. So there's a set of projection operators that are spanning. So these aren't spanning the Hilbert space. These are spanning the space of emission operators. So any emission operator can be written as a real combination of these things. And then you can write P is equal to so just the vector entries now are just the probability you get for each of these projection. These could just be positive operators. They don't have to be projection operators. You know, the set of positive operators that span the space of. K is the dimensionality of this space of emission operators or positive operators. And does anyone know what the K is in terms of the Hilbert space dimension? I use N rather than T. There seems to be some disagreement in the literature about using N or D. Yeah. So a sort of simple way of seeing that, to save you having to do anything difficult, is just to look at a density matrix and count. So you have along the diagonal, you have, let's call it, P1 down to Pn. N is the Hilbert space dimension. And then you have off-diagonal entries. And the number of probabilities in this list should be equal to the number of real parameters in this density operator. So you can count, and you have n numbers down the diagonal. Plus, then you have n times n minus 1 over two off-diagonal elements, and each of those can be is complex. You have two there. So that gives you n squared. So this is because actually, even just here, we get an interesting clue as to why we might have complex numbers. If we didn't have this 2, then k would be a less attractive function of n. N squared seems like a nice kind of function of n. It'd be interesting also to think about the case of classical probability theory and compare it to the quantum case. So first of all, let me give an operational definition to this notion n. So you can define n to be equal to the maximum number of states that can be perfectly discriminated. By perfectly, I mean in a single shot. So in the case of quantum theory, the maximum number of states that can be discriminated is some set of orthonormal states for your basis. So that gives you an operational meaning for the notion of n. And it's important, if you're going to try and derive quantum theory, then you don't really want to be using quantum, you don't keep using standard quantum concepts. So we need to give these things a more operational meaning. Okay. So yes, so how does it look in the classical case? I'm gonna risk this. So imagine that we have a classical system that has n distinguishable states. So for example, the ball that can be in one of n boxes, something like that. Then k is equal to the number of probabilities we require to specify this. And one way to specify the state of this is just to give the probability for finding the ball in each of those boxes. So you need to just give n probabilities for that. So k is equal to n. So this is interesting. So the two cases that we're most familiar with, the classical probability case and the quantum case, both have n equals k equals n to the power r. And I'll come back to that. So in this general probability framework, you have states which belong to some set of states. The set of states may vary for the type of system. So P particular for the value of n. You have measurements belong to some set of measurements. And you also think about transformations. So let me just illustrate that. In the case of quantum theory, if you have a density operator, then you act on it with a completely positive map. And then finally, you make a measurement. You get an expression like this. And in this general probability framework, you can write that down like this. Where this is a matrix, a real matrix. So you have a preparation in some state as a list of probabilities, a transformation represented as a real matrix, and then some final measurement outcome. Any questions on that? No. And so Z belongs to some set of transformations. So that's the rough idea of what a general probability theory is. One more thing that's interesting here is to think about composite systems, and then we'll start to get some hints as to where the this k equals n to the power r comes from. So this is where you have a preparation of some kind, and two or more systems come out. Denote them by A and B. And so now when you write down the state as a list of probabilities, you'll have some number of probabilities required to represent the state. And likewise, you'll have some maximum number of states that can be distinguished. Well, in the case of quantum theory, and also classical probability theory, the maximum number of states that can be distinguished for a composite system is just equal to the product of the number of states that can be distinguished for each of the component systems. Think about the classical case, you have a dice, a die, and a coin. So you have 6 times 2 is equal to 12, and that's yes, this is true for classical and quantum. And so I'll give this a name. I'll call it information locality. Because, if you take the log of this expression, then you have the number of bits of information you can store on the composite system is just equal to the number of bits you can store on each of the component systems. So it's saying that the information held by the total system is just given by the contributions from each of the parts. So this is true in the classical case of classical probability theory. It's also true in quantum theory, because I forget if it was axiom 2 or one of the axioms, if you have a composite system, you just take the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces. And so the dimensions of those Hilbert spaces multiply to give you the new Hilbert space dimension. So this is true in both of those cases. And also, it seems like a very natural thing to have be true. It seems like the kind of thing you might even want to elevate to the status of a postulate of some kind, that the total information is just the sum of the information of the parts. It doesn't have to be true. You can imagine situations where when you bring parts together, they unlock extra information that was previously hidden. But as an assumption, it seems like a natural thing to assume. Any guesses about this one? K equals K, what does K equal?
NA to the R,
oh, right, yeah, indeed, yeah, but that is true. And that has the form
KA take KB, yeah. So you get the total number of real parameters you require for a composite system. It's just the product of the numbers you require for each of the systems. I'll give this property a name. Call it tomographic locality. The reason for that is that it's equivalent to the statement that you can determine the state of a composite system by making local measurements on each of the parts and then looking at the data, the probabilistic data you collect. Yeah, so this is true also in, obviously it's true in classical probability theory because K is just equal to N, and it's also true in the quantum case. Interestingly, though, it fails to be true if you don't have complex numbers. If you have a real Hilbert space, for example, if you try to do quantum theory with an underlying real Hilbert space, so you just have a one here, then this tomographic locality fails to be true.
Why do you use the word locality?
It's a kind of locality. It's saying, when you think of it in these terms, it's saying that you can determine the total state just by making local measurements on the parts, and then looking at the looking at the statistics you collect. Yeah, definitely measuring each in different places, but you're measuring each of them locally and then collecting the data. So you don't have to, in particular, if you want to determine the state of a composite system by doing repeated measurements on repeated preparations, then you don't have to perform big entangled measurements on each of the components. All the components together, you can do it just by making separate measurements on the components. So it's a kind of locality. I mean, there are many kinds of locality in physics, and this is yet one more type of locality, actually, two more types of locality. Okay. So if you have these two constraints, and if I have one more condition, say if I have information locality and tomographic locality, and if we assume that want to assume, first of all, that the number of probabilities you require to specify the state is a function of the maximum number of distinguishable states. And we assume that this function has the property that it's strictly increasing. And also we allow ourselves all possible values for n for systems. If we make those assumptions, then you can prove that n equals, that k equals n to the power r. So this is interesting because the first case gives you classical probability theory. R equals one. Oh, sorry, this is. Yeah. The second case gives you quantum theory, and specifically, it gives you complex value quantum theory. And then the third case, and so on, gives you theories that we don't know, and it's not clear if they really exist. For those of you that are familiar with Sorkin's work on measure, he has a hierarchy. These two hierarchies seem to be related. He has a hierarchy based on interference coming in at different levels.
So what's the relation between his and Sorkin's hierarchy?
Do you know Sorkin's hierarchy? So just quickly, for those of people who don't, if you imagine a double-slit interferometer, in the classical case, you can write the stuff you get down here as just a sum of the stuff that happens through this slit plus the stuff that happens through this slit. But in the quantum case, that breaks down. However, if you go now to a three-slit experiment, and look, in the quantum case, you can write what happens here by taking into account, well, you can't get it as a sum of just the single distributions that come out of each of these, but you can get it by taking into account pairs. So that the pattern you get on here, you can calculate it from knowing what the pattern you'd get through this pair of slits, and for this pair of slits, and for this pair of slits, and also you need information about where you only have one slit. So you can get it by looking at up to two-slit interference, and then three-slit interference, and four-slit interference, and so on follows. And you can continue this hierarchy. So you can look at four slits and demand that you only have interference coming in non-trivially up to three slits. That would be a theory which is different from quantum theory, but you can consider it. And that would correspond, the R equals three case would be an example of that kind of theory, and so on. So it seems to be a connection between how much interference you have and the value of R. Okay. So it's interesting to look just in the case of sort of quantum type theories, but to consider the real complex space and the quaternionic case. If you take, let me just draw this table. So this is for real, the real quantum theory case. Then you have x equal to 1, because the numbers in your density matrix are real. And so you can calculate what k is equal to in each of these two cases. And so you can see that in the real Hilbert space case, 3 squared is 9. So kA times kB is 9. But actually here you have 10. So you have an extra, you need an extra probability in your list, which you can't determine by making local measurements. So you'd have to do an entangled measurement to determine this. And people study, they call them rebits. Sometimes people study rebits and look at their properties. So standard quantum theory has k equals 4 when n equals 2 and k equals 16. So then you satisfy that 4 squared is equal to 16. The quaternionic case is strange. You get 6 for a quaternionic bit and 28 for 2 quaternionic bits. there's something odd happening here. And it seems that it seems like you have, when you have two systems put together, some of the degrees of freedom vanish. You have fewer probabilities for a composite system than the product. And it seems really that the quaternionic systems just don't sit well in this kind of framework. There's all sorts of problems for doing quaternionic quantum theory in this kind of framework. Quaternionic quantum theory doesn't sit very well with the idea of composite systems. Okay. I've got 10 minutes. I think it just continues to get worse now. You know, the only case that works is n equal to 2 here, because this is quadratic. And so the only way to make this satisfy that is to have n equal to, x equal to 2. You can consider, you can now consider where you add, let's call this x 2. And then you'd have n minus 1, n minus 2 over 3 factorial. You can consider higher theories like this and so on. And look at, and we can even call this n1, look at the values of these x's that's consistent with this and so on, if you want to explore that. Okay. So within this kind of framework, you can write down a set of postulates. So I'll give you the postulates that I wrote down in this 2001 paper. But since then, there's been a lot of work done by other people with different sets of postulates that are in this same kind of framework. You know, there's a sort of battle of the postulates. I don't think we've really found quite the right set of postulates or quite the right perspective, but I think a lot of progress has been made in this approach. So. With this set of postulates, you can obtain a finite dimensional quantum theory. So you get the right space of states, the right space of transformations, and the right space for measurements. So first one says that systems having or constrained to have a given information carrying capacity, which is basically the N. N or log N. Have the same properties. So by that we mean they have the same spaces for states and transformations and measurements. Information locality is the second. And then the third postulate is tomographic locality. So the KAB equals KAB, KA times KB. Over here. And then two more postulates. One is that there exists a continuous reversible transformation between any pair of pure states. Yeah, for a given system. And this is true in quantum theory because you have these unitary transformations. So any pure state can be taken to any other pure state in a reversible fashion. It's not true, incidentally, in classical property theory because you have a discrete set of states. The only way to get from one to another for the pure states correspond to the extremal states. I should mention that purity means extremal in the convex set. Then you can't. You can only jump between the pure states. And then the last postulate. Is the worst one. It says that systems, it's a simplicity. Basically, this postulate wants you to take the smallest value of R that's going to do the job. So systems are described by the smallest number of probabilities consistent with the other postulates. That's a really bad postulate. And a lot of the progress that happened in the last 6 years or so, it was removing this, the need for an axiom like this or a postulate like this. So it's now been shown that there are various, so still quite reasonable postulates you can impose that get rid of the need for a simplicity postulate. So within the context of that set, those sets of assumptions, you're able to roll out the R equals 3 and higher cases. However, it's also possible that a different set of postulates that's even more reasonable doesn't rule them out, and it's interesting. It'd be interesting to find some kind of good physics for these higher cases. Any questions about this set of?
Yeah. I'm not sure I understand the last one. When you just say consistent with the other postulates, so you've shown that there's a consistent for n equals 1, right? Or r equals 1, rather.
It's not consistent with the continuity postulate. So this gets rid of that. Yeah. Yeah, the continuity in this set of postulates, the continuity postulate does a bit more than just get rid of the classical case, but it does at least that job. Yeah. So then you take the next case, which is R equals 2, and then it turns out you can get a consistent theory. And in fact, uniquely, the only theory that's consistent with the set of postulates is quantum theory. So the reconstruction isn't very difficult, but still it's a bit laborious. And you have to, first of all, you reconstruct the qubit. So you can kind of imagine that using this continuity, you're going to get some ball. You start to look at that. You have a group of reversible transformations. It's going to give you a ball. So that gives you the qubit, and then you use the qubit to reconstruct, and this postulate especially, to get the right state space for the higher dimensional cases. Yeah.
That's the postulate I'm not sure I understand.
Which one? The first one.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So,
are you saying that any two systems that have the same number of states are identified?
They have. It's possible between in quantum theory. This is incidentally without superselection rules, which brings a different set of issues forward. But in quantum theory, any two systems that have the same n have the same Hilbert space, and therefore they have the same space of states, the same space of transformations possible, and the same space of measurements. Because all those things are built out of the Hilbert space and nothing else. In some sense, this information postulate, or this particular feature of quantum theory, and also classical quantum theories, is responsible for the possibility of computer science and information. You know, that if you have a qubit, it doesn't matter if that qubit is built out of the polarization of a photon or the spin degree of an electron or whatever. It has all the same properties, so there's a kind of fungibility property that you can take information that's encoded in one type of system, and encode it in another type of system. And there's something. I think prior to quantum information coming along, people were over and over again deriving the same or discovering the same properties, but just in the different settings. So, in the context of interferometers, in the context of spin dynamics, in the context of quantum optics, but really over and over again, the only thing that matters is the Hilbert space dimension.
Yeah. So in particular, that is encoding the Ka equals K of Na.
Yeah. So in order to get that, you use this.
I want to see how, like, putting these restrictions on you, there you restrict the idea to say, like, your states, for instance, are similar to the space or something.
Is what, sorry?
You kind of like, by putting, if you start with just these postulates, you wind up with something effectively saying the state space is isomorphic to a Hilbert space.
Right, yeah, or isomorphic to density operators acting on a Hilbert space, yeah.
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 But then, what is, you don't seem to, I'm trying to see where you, like, you say something about measurement.
Yeah, so you, there's a similar story for measurement that you have to prove that your measurement, or each outcome of a measurement, can be associated with a positive operator, and that's something that has to be proven as well. And a similar story for transformations, that your transformations have to be isomorphic to completely positive maps.
Yeah, I mean, like, it doesn't, how does this deal with, say, collapse? Or
right, so this is an operational approach, and so
yeah.
It's kind of agnostic about the interpretational issues concerning collapse and so on, but it does give you the right kind of projection postulates, if you like, that so just imagine if you have one of these I can't see the right board now, but you have one of these, I think I erased it, maybe the if you have this Z transformation, so you send a system in, you hit it with a transformation, the thing that comes out is going to be projected in some way. And so you just have to find the right space of Zs that correspond to quantum theory. It's just a map on these lists of probabilities. You kind of get all this just by thinking in operational terms without worrying about the ontological questions. In some sense, this sort of program is and for me, ironically, is motivated by the Copenhagen way of thinking. Certainly, that idea that Copenhagen means just do the calculation and don't worry about it. This is very much like that. But yes.
Okay, but you mentioned super selection rules. Let's
right.
What that means.
Yeah. So once you put super selection rules in, then you break this postulate. Because depending, different ways of imposing super selection rules, you have different super selection sectors, and then the number of degrees of freedom will not just be a function of k, but a function of n. It also depends on, so this won't be true, but it will also depend on how you've split up your Hilbert space into super selection sectors. So it just fails. And I think that's a serious issue because, super selection rules do play a role in fundamental physics, at least as we understand it. And I don't have a good response to that problem.
So the variables that play a fundamental role here are n and k.
Right.
N has a very simple definition.
Yeah.
I can see how k is calculated, like, for instance, from that formula, but what's the definition of k?
K is the minimum number of probabilities you need to specify the state. Yeah. So in the case of quantum theory, you only want to give an overcomplete set of positive operators, just complete. A minimal set of standard space. Yeah. Or equivalently, K is the dimension of the S space. S is a space embedded in, it's got a, S is a convex set and it has a certain dimension. S is the size of that space, or the dimension of that space. I guess it's we're over time and it's the afternoon as well, so let's stop there.